Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of conversation with scholars about research and the formulation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. My guest today, I'm very pleased to say, is Ronald Patkus, historian and associate director of the Library for Archives and Special Collections here at Vassar College. Ron is here to talk with us about his most recent book. The title is The Privately Printed Bible, Private and Fine Press Editions of Biblical Texts in the British Isles and North America, 1892 to 2000, just published by Oak Knoll Press. Welcome, Ron.
Thanks, Tom. Happy to be here. Really happy to be a part of this program. As you know, I'm a great fan of your show, I think this is one of the best programs in the area and one of the best things going on at Vassar. You've done so many wonderful interviews with important authors, and I'm really happy to be here.
Yeah, it's nice of you to say that. Well, I have to have you on the show more often than for the future. So, and we could do, actually, you know, your exhibits more than we do.
Oh.
I mean, do Art Center exhibits, but,
yeah.
You know, exhibits come and go in the main library, including one we have up now, the Homer exhibit, The Odyssey, which
we
would be
do.
Interesting. Yeah, we should, because I'm sure the listening audience would be interested. First question, since this project comes out of your role as Special Collections Librarian and your library here at Vassar, can you talk about archives and special collections in general?
So. It's an amazing library. Mm-hmm. You know, wherever I go, I'm always happy to tell people about it. Vassar has one of the greatest undergraduate libraries in general, but its special collections are very strong.
Mm-hmm.
It has a very long tradition. As you know, it goes back to the founders of the school. Matthew Vassar was, from the beginning, very keen on developing an institution that relied on resources in undergraduate teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And so from the beginning, the library was affected by that approach. It became even more important as the 19th century progressed, thinking of teachers like Lucy Maynard Salmon,
mm-hmm.
Herbert Mills, William Bancroft Hill.
Mm-hmm.
Each of them wanted to use sources in their teaching. They were therefore very active in acquiring sources.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't just them alone.
Yeah.
They also connected with alums and the librarians. And so over the course of the 19th and 20th century, Vassar really developed an incredible library, especially rich in primary sources.
Mm-hmm.
And people like you and I, who are fortunate to work here nowadays, yeah. we can draw on that.
Yeah.
We, of course, want to continue that work as well. But there's been a really rich legacy left, and it makes for a wonderful educational experience, I think, for our students.
Yeah, we do have this sort of motto. It becomes a cliche after a while, but we keep coming back to it, going to the source as a
yes.
pedagogy, as a value-added thing in the institution. And it's really very much alive and surprising, coming even from Yale, how much research counts as a way of teaching people.
Going to the source is institution-wide.
Yeah.
I mean, it's when a student is able to look at a star from our observatory
mm-hmm.
or look at a geologic specimen in the Rock Museum
mm-hmm.
or a painting in the Art Center or a book in the library. So I feel like we're part of a larger context, but we also, of course, want to develop what we have in the library.
Yeah, interesting. Lucy Salmon was a really interesting individual in this because she pushed a method of teaching that relied on not just sources, but ephemeral sources sometimes. So she would collect, you know, literally laundry receipts, menus, that kind of thing to do history.
Indeed,
know.
And one of the famous stories that has come down is about Lucy Maynard Salmon giving a test
mm-hmm.
to the undergraduate history students in which she simply handed out a train schedule
uh-huh.
from the Midwest
yeah.
in, I don't know what year it was, probably in the 19th
yeah.
century. And from that one source, the question on the test was, write a history of the American West.
Uh-huh.
Very provocative.
Yeah.
You can see how that would force a student to think about transportation
yeah.
and the development of the West, and
yeah.
all of that comes from this one source. You can also imagine how they could make certain arguments based on whatever that source said.
Yeah.
So it's a way of learning, I think, that you don't always find in undergraduate settings.
Yeah, no.
The more typical one, perhaps, is where a professor lectures at a student
uh-huh.
or students, and they're expected to regurgitate at the end of the semester.
Yeah.
This kind of learning is different. It's showing you the world mm-hmm. and asking you still to think about it, but to come up with your own arguments based on those sources, yeah. of course. But that's a different kind of learning. And yeah. many don't get to partake of that until they're a graduate student, or maybe even never. Yeah. And it's really wonderful, I think, that Vassar still has that as a critical part of their yeah. educational approach. Maybe it's one thing that makes a Vassar education unique.
It's interesting that it's passed on through the generations in the faculty, orally, too.
Indeed.
Yeah. So
because it would be one thing to say, oh, there was this wonderful history.
Yeah.
But it's absolutely happening today. I have collaborations with a lot of faculty from a variety of disciplines on campus, and they really are the ones who are keeping it going today, and I hope it continues.
Me too. And it makes for happy librarians.
Indeed. That's another part of it, if I could just say as well, that the library is therefore a partner with the faculty yeah. in a very real way in the learning enterprise yeah. that goes on here. I think that makes for wonderful collaborations, but it also benefits the students.
Faculty are a big part of what we do. I mean, they help develop the collection, that's for sure. And we think about them all the time and I talk about yeah. what they're teaching. So then you teach also then, don't you? And that's part of what you do as a librarian, but it also nestles you into what everybody else is doing in a nice way.
Yeah, and actually part of my job title locates me in the history department. Uh-huh. So I'm both working in the rare books library, but I also teach
function as a historian. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Many of my courses, though, are offered through media studies, mm-hmm. and that's because much of my work deals with the history of the book.
The book, yeah.
And the history of printing.
Yeah.
And so I offer courses like a general history of the book. Last semester, we did a course that I co-taught with Rachel Friedman on the history of the texts of the Odyssey. Mm-hmm. Just now I'm doing a course on medieval manuscripts with Mark Epstein. Mm-hmm. So a lot of my courses deal in some way with some aspect yeah. of the book. I've also done one, of course, on the history of the Bible mm-hmm. as a book.
Yeah. So media studies certainly makes sense, but in a way this is it's a history of technology in a way, and that the libraries and books are a technology and a very functional technology, and they have a lot to tell us about digital technology in a way, don't they? So
I think so.
Yeah. I can see this was a big research project. Did the privately printed Bible come out of your biblical class?
Yeah, I started out, I think it was in 2010, offering a course called The Printed Bible, uh-huh. which basically went from Gutenberg to the present.
Yeah.
After that, I co-taught with another library colleague, Deborah Bucher, a course called The Bible as a Book. And with that, we had a longer chronological expanse. We basically started from the very beginning. Deb is expert in those areas, mm-hmm. and we brought it to the present.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was while teaching one of those courses that, you know, when we got to the period of the 20th century, I wanted to investigate some of the books that had been produced by private and fine presses. Uh-huh. And in looking for readings for the students, found that there wasn't really very much. There's some, but nothing really that served as an overview.
Yeah.
And that's one thing that made me think about taking this on as a research project.
Yeah, most scholarship on private presses tends to go for their literary productions, right? Their very literary productions, which are numerous, of course. They tend to like to print literature, but Bibles not so much, I guess.
Yeah, in fact, when I looked at the literature in general, the thing I was finding is in the field of Bible studies, mm-hmm. There's a very rich bibliography of works on the history of the Bible.
Yeah, that must be daunting, but at first look. I know it is because my wife was a divinity student at Yale and a religion student, I know how deep that scholarship is.
It's very deep, including in the 20th century.
Yeah.
But there's not much attention in that field to private presses.
Yeah.
And then conversely, I found that in the literature of private presses, there's a substantial literature there too, but little that concentrated on the Bible.
Yeah.
So both fields, there was an area of neglect on the topic of private press Bibles.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean a book needs to be written, but as I explored it, it seemed like this did tell an important part of the story of both the history of the Bible and the history of private presses.
Uh-huh.
So bringing that together, I felt that it was worth pursuing as a book project.
Yeah, it's interesting. So this is a kind of a bibliography, but it's a sort of synthetic bibliography, not a comprehensive one necessarily.
Yeah, I think I'd call it a survey.
A survey,
maybe.
Okay. A bibliographic survey then.
You know, I wouldn't say it's just a straight bibliography. There's obviously a narrative text, but really what I'm trying to do is survey the field and bring that out in the literature. I can certainly imagine other things following from that.
Yeah. So did you have a special audience in mind? Was it students, or was it book people, or was it religion people? Or...
Yeah. Initially, of course, I was thinking about my students simply because that's the course I was teaching. But as I got serious about the project, I felt that my audience should be wider. And as I wrote it, I certainly felt that it should be a wider audience. Mm-hmm. Partly because I think many of these books, although they include works by major artists, major designers, they're not very well known. And I would like there to be a wider acknowledgement of that. So I was imagining a wider audience.
Certainly there are a lot of implications here for people interested in theological studies and Bible studies and the history of the reading of the Bible in the 20th century. You know, what books are important, that kind of thing. You did a lot of tabular work figuring out what was of interest and how it was being read. And also the history of illustration is really important here.
All those things, I think, play an important part in this study.
So how did you then scope the book? Because I know what constitutes a fine press or a private press, it's sometimes hard to define. People that work in this area have a hard time sometimes talking about what does and what doesn't. And especially if you reach back. I mean, is Gutenberg's Bible a private press Bible? Because in a way it is, you know, certainly in the techniques that were used, that he invented.
It's an excellent question, and it's an important one that I had to sort out before I got very far along.
Yeah.
As you said, the question of what is a private press is perennially a troubled question.
Yeah.
It's always a question because it's hard to define exactly what a private press is.
Yeah.
Usually, the first thing that person thinks about, it's something that's run by a private individual.
Yeah.
Secondly, they're printing what they want, and they don't necessarily have a commercial interest in the project. They just want to print something. And the third thing maybe is that often, although not always, private presses include some craft aspect to their work.
Yeah.
They may be printing with handmade paper or illustrations made by an artist that they're collaborating with or something. So those are some general things that come together. You still can't provide a hard and fast definition. And usually most bibliographers end up wanting to take a broad view. Mm-hmm. Rather than trying to be strict in their definitions. And I certainly took that approach as well.
Yeah.
Keep it open as much as possible.
But you do have a timeline, because the movement really takes off in the 19th century, because it's part of the arts and crafts movement, isn't it? Yeah.
I do have a timeline. And as you say, it's certainly possible to trace a history of private press printing back to the earliest days of printing.
Yeah.
Roderick Cave, in his classic seminal book on private press, mentions a number of examples.
Mm-hmm.
With that said, there is certainly a revival that takes place at the end of the 19th century. And many people, in fact, think of private press printing as beginning then. That might be stating it a little too strongly, but I did feel, for my book, I concentrated on the period from the private press revival, even though I have some introductory text about the period before that.
Reminds me of the slow food movement a little bit, you know. people wanting to do things the way they used to be done, though, without, you know, so.
There are some other limitations with the book in the sense that geographically, for this volume, I'm focusing on North America and the British Isles.
Yeah.
There are private presses in other places, but I limited this book to those places as well.
Also, there's a question here about what to include, because these aren't necessarily all whole Bibles like the Gutenberg Bible.
Right.
There are some, but there are pieces that are printed also.
Thank you. In fact, if I limited it just to entire Bibles, it would be a much shorter book, especially when focusing on private presses, because to print the entire Bible in a private press setting is a very big undertaking. You know, in that sense, easier for a commercial press to print such a big book. So yes, I'm including printings of just single books of the Bible, or even just excerpted texts. With that said, bringing those together, I identified well over 500 examples in the UK and the US, and to me that's a substantial sample. And that's precisely one thing I wanted to bring to the audience was this wide sampling and how it fits into the history of printing in the 20th century.
Yeah, interesting. When we were talking about defining private press, is money sometimes involved, and that commercial printing is designed to make money on books, but private press people don't seem to be as concerned about money necessarily, but they do have to recoup their costs somehow. So is that a consideration in what you call private press?
No, I think it probably varies from press to press, but typically for a private press, that's not their first interest.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that they're not going to sell the book or that they don't want to recoup some of their money.
Yeah.
It just means that maybe it's not the key driving force.
Yeah, these are real craftsmen that they tend to be. So they're thinking about the art, the product, and then hoping to make money on it later. But there are book clubs and that kind of thing. There are methods for recouping costs here, aren't there?
Yes.
Yeah.
I should also say, Tom, that I'm also including in the study not just what we would call private presses, but also fine presses.
Uh-huh.
And your question about costs reminded me of that, that a fine press really is focused on the craft of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And they very often are selling their books and wanting to recover their costs and maybe even make something of a profit. But their key connection is with the craft of the book. So many people often will consider the two of them together. You can see many fine presses working out of the tradition of the larger private press movement. But I just wanted to be clear about some of their potential differences.
Yeah. Many of the examples, and there are many, many plates in here, I should say, in the book. It's very heavily illustrated, nicely illustrated. Beautiful examples, both of printing and illustration. But they're not all in our collection. Some are, but some aren't, yes.
Right. I was able to rely heavily on Vassar's collection. Vassar actually has a separately conceived Bible collection.
Yeah, which is why you decided to teach the class in part, right?
Absolutely. So, that we had that resource there for the course.
Yeah.
That collection is very interesting. Many people wouldn't imagine that Vassar would have a Bible collection.
Yeah, we were non-denominational right from the get-go, right? I mean, the old chapel is an ecumenical chapel.
Yeah. It's true, although when in the late 19th century Vassar founded a so-called Bible department,
mm-hmm.
that later transformed into today's religion
department,
but it was initially called the Bible department.
Uh-huh.
And the first incumbent, the first professor, was named William Bancroft Hill, and he was both a minister but also a professor. But like some of these others at Vassar, like Lucy Maynard Salmon and Herbert E. Mills, he felt that the development of resources was important to the teaching of his discipline.
Uh-huh.
And so he literally used some of the funds that were part of his chair. It's called the Weyerhaeuser Chair.
Uh-huh.
He used some of those funds to develop the Bible collection.
Mm-hmm.
And he therefore bought many historical Bibles from a variety of locations in a variety of languages.
Yeah.
He really started an impressive collection. He, of course, since he was living in the late 19th and early 20th century, was only in the beginning stages of my period.
Yeah.
But he started that collection, and it continued to develop across the 20th century.
Yes, so a variety of translations maybe was what he might have been interested in.
Primarily,
So I'm thinking that it was the same thing with Shakespeare. We collected lots of editions of Shakespeare, and we were doing textual criticism on the first folio and that kind of thing. So so people are of the same mind about the study of these texts in a way. And then media studies is important right then from the get-go because the edition is important.
I agree.
But
to your initial question, Vassar's collection wouldn't alone support this study.
Uh-huh.
I definitely needed to travel to a number of other libraries, both in the UK and the US.
Yeah.
British libraries in the UK and in the US, I guess I'd mention two libraries in particular. One is the New York Public Library, not far from us, which has very strong holdings in private press printings. And they were very helpful, and I had a number of visits there. I also received a fellowship to work at the Bridewell Library at Southern Methodist University in Dallas.
Uh-huh.
And they have an excellent collection as well.
Uh-huh. So you traveled down there and stayed for a while?
I stayed there for 2 weeks, and they were very helpful. And in fact, a number of the images in the book come from both, they mainly come actually from Vassar, the New York Public Library, and the Bridewell Library.
Uh-huh.
There were other libraries I visited well, but I'd especially mention those. Yeah.
So the Bible, of course, is hugely important in the history of printing as a text. It's starting right off the blocks with Gutenberg. We had Alex Christie on the show talking about her book, which is a historical fiction, Gutenberg's Apprentice. Right. She's a Vassar alum. Gave a really good idea of what went into that first Bible. How many years it took, how many people it took. Sort of machinations that Gutenberg had to go through, political and otherwise, to get the thing published and sold. So the Bible's an important text right from the get-go. So are these private press people cognizant that they're walking in the steps of Johannes Gutenberg here, do you think, or is it hard to say? I mean,
I think especially with the revival of private press printing in the late 19th century, they are definitely cognizant of the history of printing. Mm-hmm. I think, for instance, of William Morris, who is often cited as a medievalist because he's looking back to that earlier time and thinking about the way they made books. Uh-huh. And I think other of his colleagues in the arts and crafts movement had similar outlooks, and perhaps that continues throughout the 20th century as well.
Most of the techniques that Gutenberg developed for the Bible were in place even at the beginning of the 19th century still. They were basically the way printing was still done. I mean, so he would be a source just for technique. But interesting that, you know, the Bible was his text there in a way.
That the very first book ever printed was, in fact, the Bible.
The Bible, So can you talk more about the private press revival in the 19th century in England with Morris and company?
The revival happens at the end of the century. And, of course, what had been happening in printing throughout most of the 19th century was that it had become mechanized. And we have the beginning of what was called the machine press period of printing, following on the hand press period. And not to speak of it pejoratively, but that time simply was a different age of printing. And some people did think of it in critical terms. Eventually, they thought the typefaces were not as good as the typefaces of an earlier time. They thought the materials that were being used weren't as good as an earlier time, etc. And William Morris is often held up as perhaps one of the key figures in wanting to take a different route in printing. He established, as you know, the Kelmscott Press in 1891, which had a short life. It only lasted until 1898. He died in 1896. Yeah. And they only printed a little over 50 books.
Was that all?
Yeah. And Vassar has a substantial number of them. But they made a substantial impact and connected with others who were interested in pursuing that kind of printing. Yeah. And altogether, we have what's usually referred to as a revival of private press printing at the end of the 19th century. Other presses in England at that time, well, the Triple Crown would be the Kelmscott Press of William Morris, the Dove's Press of T.J. Cobden Sanderson, and the Ash and Dean Press of C.H. St. John Hornby. Yeah. They're often seen as the three key British private presses of the late 19th and early 20th century. There were others, but they have a very strong impact both in the U.K., in Europe, and in the U.S.
Yeah. So these are craftsmen that put these books together, and it requires different kinds of craftsmen, doesn't it? So you have illustrators, you have people that can lay type, even people that design pages, and the printers themselves. So
In typical private press fashion, there's no set of rules for what they have to do, and so there's some variety in what happens. Yeah. Cobden Sanderson, for instance, at the Dove's Press, he started out as a bookbinder. But then he got interested in printing as well. He founded that press with Emery Walker, another important person in printing in England at the time. But each press could put together its own arrangements for how the book could be produced. Maybe they would collaborate with some artists. Maybe they wouldn't. Maybe they would collaborate with a certain designer. Maybe they wouldn't. So there's some flexibility there.
So for these presses, what would make the Bible appeal to them? I mean, why was it a text? It seems to have been an important text right from the beginning here also in a way.
That's an excellent question, and that was an important question that I had to explore.
Yeah. Morris was not a great Bible thumper, was he? I mean, you don't think of him in those
terms. You certainly don't think of him in those terms, although just before he died, I found a newspaper article about this. It was stated that he was planning on printing the entire Bible. And in fact,
with Kelmscott,
And Dove's did print the entire Bible. I think, though, and Cobden Sanderson at the Dove's Press is a good example of this, that they were thinking of the Bible not so much as a religious text, but more as a literary text. And one thing that really bears that out, I think, is the particular books of the Bible that they printed. The ones that they printed are the ones that are referred to as the books of poetry and wisdom.
Psalms and
Song of Songs, Job, Ecclesiastes, Proverbs. In fact, if you total up among the private presses the printings of the books of poetry and wisdom, it constitutes the largest quantity of books of my sample. So I think they were moved by a literary impulse. Also, of course, they were mostly printing the King James translation. Not always, but often. And I think they were therefore trying to produce a certain kind of book from those literary beginnings.
Did Burne Jones work with Kelmscott?
Absolutely. Yeah. Edward Burne Jones was a close friend of Morris from college days at Oxford, and they collaborated on a number of projects, including one of the first books printed at the Kelmscott Press was called Biblia Innocentium, the Bible of Innocence, and it was a retelling of the Bible by a guy named J.W. McHale. And Burne Jones was asked to produce illustrations. He couldn't get them finished quite in time, so Kelmscott printed the book first without the illustrations. Later, though, after Burne Jones died, his wife brought together the illustrations that had been created for the book of Genesis. And they were printed both in the UK and the US under other titles. And so we actually have a view of perhaps what
the Bible
an entire Kelmscott Bible might have looked like based on some of those illustrations. Burne Jones, he's not the only illustrator that worked for Kelmscott, but he was probably the most important.
The Doves Press, they actually did a whole Bible.
Yes.
Didn't they? It's a famous Bible.
Yeah, the Doves Press Bible, I think, is perhaps the most well-known printing of the entire text of the Bible by a private press. In fact, I asked that the front cover design of my book include reference to that, and our designer, Jerry Kelly, did in a very creative way include that.
So it's sort of like an upside-down L with a big in the beginning and rubrics across the top. And
yes, those letters in red in the beginning, the first words of the first book of the Bible, are what people think of when they think of the Doves Press Bible. That was printed between 1903 and 1905. Took a number of years for it to be printed. It was printed in a limited edition. It is very different from the books of, say, the Kelmscott Press in that it is not illustrated. Cobden Sanderson was very interested in typography. And apart from the lettering done by the calligrapher Edward Johnston, there's very little decoration in that book, but it's a marvelous work of printing. And the typography is quite amazing. Some think it's simplistic or even severe.
Well, it's sort of minimalist in a way, I guess.
Maybe minimalist is another way to think of it. But in any case, it certainly was an important work, and even today stands as an important landmark. I should say, too, for our listeners may be interested in this, that Vassar, of course, has a copy of the Doves Press Bible, but Vassar's copy was bound at the Doves Bindery. So that's really amazing because Cobden Sanderson, of course, started out as a binder. So we not only have his masterwork in printing, but it was bound at the Doves Bindery as well. So it's a really remarkable example that we have.
So what about other kinds of presses? I know there are books that are done by what are called school presses, and you include those. Those are fine presses sometimes, or at least private presses.
In other words, I'm including presses that operate in schools, usually colleges, or sometimes professional schools. And one of the earliest ones was the Central School of Arts and Crafts, which was founded during the first period of my study in London. It was run for many years by J.H. Mason, and he oversaw a number of projects, of course, but a couple of them going forward dealt with the Bible. And I wanted to include these presses in the study as well, because they tell us something To me, not to have included them would have been more of a problem.
Yeah.
I should say, I also include some of the important book clubs, like the Limited Editions Club.
Yeah.
They're, of course, not a private press, but they often worked very closely with private or
presses,
fine
yeah.
presses. And so there, too, I felt it was better
nice
to include them.
Things, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, to include them yeah. than to not include them.
Yeah. So the private press movement does make it to America, finally, especially with the Roycrofters.
Yes, the movement does come to America. Roycrofters is one of the early instances that I mentioned. That's founded in Western New York
yeah.
State.
Yeah, is it Amherst, I think? Or is it East Aurora?
East Aurora,
East Aurora,
thank you. Elbert Hubbard
yeah.
Was the person behind all of that. He had an interesting operation. It was a big operation, so there's some question about whether it really should be considered a private press.
Yeah.
But others have included it, and I included it as well.
Yeah, there's a nice museum still there in East Aurora.
Yeah. One thing we should say, as the press comes to America, there were some true private presses that begin printing. But also in America, a number of commercial presses
yeah.
take on many of the ideals of the private press.
Uh-huh.
In other words, they integrate some of these craft ideals in
yeah.
their printing,
uh-huh.
even though
yeah.
they're really not private presses, but
yeah.
they may be working in the tradition
yeah.
of.
Yeah.
In the tradition is sort of a concept that Will Ransom,
yeah.
who wrote the famous book on private presses and their books
yeah.
in the 1920s, is a concept he used, and I think it's useful here.
One skill that goes into these is the making of type and typography. People who fashion type. And you see it. I mean, if you look through the illustrations in the book, you don't have to see a Burne Jones or a famous illustrator's work to see how beautiful some of these pages are, just in the type and the way it's set. One name that comes out early on is Frederick Gowdy, who's with the Village Press, I think. He's an American. And also, I think he's associated with Vassar as a type designer.
Yeah, not all private presses, of course, would make their own type.
No.
They might go to a type foundry to acquire type.
Yeah.
But many presses worked closely with designers, and
yeah.
one of the key early 20th century figures that we think of is Frederick Gowdy.
Uh-huh.
Gowdy's press was called the Village Press.
Uh-huh.
It actually was founded in Chicago. It then moved to Massachusetts, then moved to New York City, and eventually he landed not very far from Vassar, near the Hudson River. And it was while he was located there that he developed a relationship with the Vassar Library. And the Vassar Library today has a very substantial Village Press collection. In fact, I think it's one of the largest in the country, others being at the Grolier Club and the Library of Congress. But we developed a close relationship with him because of his proximity to the campus. And we have many interesting pieces in our holdings. It's a nearly complete collection of the printed works, but also other items such as manuscripts, and we even have some examples of his type.
It's a beautiful type, I have to say. When I started here, all our letterhead was in Gowdy. I don't think it is anymore.
And Gowdy influenced other private presses working at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, they might use some of his types.
Yeah.
Gowdy type, for instance, is widespread.
In the early period, before the end of World War I, are there any conclusions that can come to? I mean, do you see trends from the representative works that you've collected here in the United States and in England? What kinds of parts of the Bible were concentrated on? What kinds of printing were being done?
I guess I'd say a couple of things for the era of the Revival. One is, aesthetically, we definitely see the artistic influence of the arts and crafts movement.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And if you look, for instance, in the illustrations for that chapter, you'll see that many of the books have similarities in their aesthetics, basically operating in an arts and crafts.
Yeah, sort of it runs from Pre-Raphaelite to Art Nouveau to, you know, Biomere, a lot of sort of flowing line.
Exactly. Yeah. Also nature.
Incredibly beautiful.
I think so.
Design, yeah.
In terms of the selection of texts, there's a slight preference for the Old Testament, but there too, the books of poetry.
Yeah.
And so already from the beginning, in the first era, we see a preference for those kinds of literary texts, I think.
Yeah, one thing to remember from the publisher's point of view is the Bible's always a good seller, right? I mean, people always, you're not sure what people's tastes are, in this period especially. Yeah.
Texts like the Book of Psalms, the Song of Songs,
mm-hmm.
those are the two highest printed.
So on to then the second generation, the interwar period. So there are major publishers and figures here that appear, right? And the presses are still doing Bibles, aren't they?
So I call this the second chapter, the second generation, because I see them following in the footsteps of the private press revival.
Yeah.
They knew many of those people. There was the disruption of World War I. But then from about 1920 to 1945, they really get back to work. And in fact, there's a great increase in the number of printed books. It's really the golden age of private press printing, 20s and the 30s.
It's a fertile period in the realm of design generally, isn't it?
Yeah. Others write about this in terms of the book world as well. In terms of private presses in England, there are three, again, that stand out. That would be, first of all, the Golden Cockerel Press, also the Nonsuch Press, and finally the Gregynog Press, which was in Wales. Nonsuch was founded by Francis Meynell. He was especially known for being very open in the way he conceived of books. He wanted each book to be different, and he's also known for collaborating with outside book people. So he was not afraid to use machine presses, for instance. But he built up a great variety of work over time. The Golden Cockerel Press was more closely a private press. They put out an amazing number of books. They collaborated with some important illustrators, especially one thinks of Eric Gill and Blair Hugh Stanton, others as well. But many of the key illustrators at the time worked for Golden Cockerel. In fact, one of the key works at the time was the Golden Cockerel Four Gospels, which was illustrated by Gill. And also he created the typeface for that book. And in fact, we should say that there's been a monograph that was written some years ago by John Dreyfuss precisely on that book, the Four Gospels, and it was called A Typographical Masterpiece. And that just shows you something about the regard that that book is held in among bibliographers.
Gill, like Gowdy, was known as a type designer apart from being a famous illustrator, right? So very versatile artist and beautiful illustrator.
I should also say, not only in the UK, but in the US of that period, some important presses emerged, both on the East Coast and the West Coast. On the East Coast, I think especially of the press of Rudge. He's worth noting. He's definitely working in the tradition. But a number of the people that he hired later went on to found their own presses. And so he had a great influence on the West Coast, I think, especially of the Grabhorn Press in San Francisco. Grabhorns landed in San Francisco having heard about John Henry Nash, the so-called Aldus of printing in San Francisco. But they established themselves and did some very interesting and creative work, especially in the 20s, 30s, and 40s of this time period. And a number of those texts were biblical in nature. They, too, worked with important artists of the time, such as Valenti Angelo.
So the illustration at this time, there's a hint of modernism that comes in. So it's very deco. It can be geometric in a way.
I can tell you're an art librarian. But you're absolutely right. We're moving away from the aesthetics of the arts and crafts period, and we're getting more into Art Deco, and as you say, even modernism, there are hints of that. An altogether different aesthetic, which again is plain to see if you just look at the group of illustrations from the end of the second chapter, comparing them to the group at the end of the first chapter.
So interestingly, we're in the Jazz Age here, but people are still reading the Bible, right? So
they're still printing the Bible, at least. They're still looking at it as a book.
And then the Depression comes, of course, so maybe, maybe there's some solace there. And we were talking about the Dove's Bible. Then there's another great Bible that's produced in this period. It's called the Oxford Lectern Bible.
The Four Gospels by the Golden Cockerel is important, but so is the so-called Oxford Lectern Bible. It's called that because it was actually produced in Oxford at the Oxford University Press. The key figure behind it, though, was Bruce Rogers, who was an American, and who was one of those people who had worked at Rudge that I mentioned just a minute ago.
You used to hear his name mentioned when I worked in the Beinecke. He always was somebody that worked in the Beinecke. You'd hear his name so often,
He had also previously worked in Cambridge before going to Rudge, Cambridge, Massachusetts. Anyway, he was one of the important designers of the time, along with Gowdy, and he spent some considerable time in England. Mm-hmm. And at one point in the 30s, there was a discussion about whether to create a Bible, and he came on and joined that project. There was a modified version of his own Centaur type mm-hmm. that was used. Uh-huh. And you can imagine, since this was a book for a lectern, it was quite large.
Yeah.
There were actually a couple of different sizes produced.
Yeah.
The bulk of them were meant to be placed on the lecterns of the churches in England,
yeah.
just like the first King James Bible
yeah.
was.
Yeah.
But then a smaller number of copies were printed that were a bit larger that could be collected by other private owners.
So were these illustrated?
They were not illustrated,
yeah.
but there was decoration
yeah.
within the book.
Uh-huh.
There's a picture of the opening page of Genesis in my book. I wish I could show it to your viewers. You can Google it and at least find it there. It's a remarkably elegant and beautiful and balanced page.
Yes.
And here's another interesting Vassar connection, which is that Vassar's copy of the Oxford Lectern Bible, wait till you hear this,
mm-hmm.
Vassar's copy was given by Bruce Rogers
uh-huh.
to Frederick Gowdy,
oh.
the other
oh.
great typographer that we just talked
yeah.
about, and he donated it to the Vassar
yeah.
Library.
Did he inscribe it by any chance?
And it is absolutely
great.
Inscribed.
That's great.
So we have this remarkable
yeah.
real treasure
great.
In our library.
So you've got the book broken up into periods, you know, the
yes.
arts and crafts movement and then the interwar period here. Then finally, the big third period starts with the Second World War and then runs through about 1969, 1970, which was
yes.
also a kind of cultural break. So can you talk about that period a bit?
Yeah. To me, a lot of the books from this time period are defined by some of those larger changes that we're seeing in the culture of society.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And
lots of translations of the Bible coming out then, right? Not as much as later, maybe after 69, but there's still, it's not just all King James
right.
and Douay, so.
Absolutely. In the field of Bible printing in general, we start to see the decline of the King James, actually. But in the fields of private press printing, you know, I think, for instance, say in England, I think of the Circle Press,
uh-huh.
which was run by Ron King,
mm-hmm.
and he did a printing of the Song of Songs.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a remarkable book. The illustrations really, to me, reflect the changes that are happening in the 1960s. Here's this wonderful poem on the Song of Songs. The illustrations, though, are very colorful that King produced.
Mm-hmm.
They run across the page. They're very symbolic.
Mm-hmm.
They're not literal.
Yeah.
And I think the aesthetic, if you look at that, you would almost guess, if no one told you, you'd have to guess that it was produced in the late 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very beautiful book.
Yeah. And then after the 60s, then there really are a plethora of translations. It's not just the Oxford translation of King James and one or two more. And anything seems to go in a way. But it's also a very creative period, isn't it, for private presses and also for illustration.
Absolutely. And in fact, the most number of printings that I found were from 1970 to 2000. I actually didn't expect that.
No.
But it shows ongoing interest in the biblical text
yeah.
among private and fine presses.
Yeah.
Two of the key accomplishments of the time are the printings of the entire Bible,
yeah.
one by the Pennyroyal Caxton Press
uh-huh.
of Barry Mosier, and the other by the Arion Press in San Francisco,
uh-huh.
the successors of the Grabhorn Press.
Yeah.
They each produced the examples of the entire text of the Bible.
Yeah.
The Barry Mosier was illustrated by Mosier with wood engravings.
Wow.
The Arion Press was in the tradition of the Oxford Lectern Bible
yeah.
and stood in that tradition.
Yeah, maybe the last hand-produced full Bible that we'll see.
It may well be.
Yeah. Yeah.
It may well be. In any case, they're both remarkably beautiful productions. Vassar has copies of each of them, and if anyone has a chance, I would really encourage taking a look at them.
Yeah. So along the 1990s, you start to get digital text or digitally produced print even, and then since 2000, digital has really taken off. So is that going to affect the way we approach the Bible, and has it affected the private press movement?
Those are questions that the private press community has definitely been dealing with.
Yeah.
There's a magazine called Parenthesis
mm-hmm.
for the community, and shortly after the turning of the millennium, there was an issue that was devoted to many of these questions.
Uh-huh.
Of course, there are no solid answers, but I think it seems that private press printing and fine press printing is certainly continuing.
Yeah.
It's still very vibrant.
Yeah.
And as I note in my final chapter, there are still significant numbers of printings of biblical texts.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So it seems as if this trend that I begin to discuss, especially at the end of the 19th century, is still continuing.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. I wonder for the same reasons in a way, because you know, during the revival, it was mechanization that turned people to the slow print movement in a way. So it's mechanization again, and you know, kind of a reduction of quality of what you read. So,
yeah, I think for people like you and me, it's hard not to see a hand-printed book and not be impressed with the materials, the designs.
Yeah. Well, case in point, your book, Oak Knoll has produced it probably with a lot of digital help, I would think. I mean, these aren't letterpress pages in here, but they're beautiful illustrations, so they did a nice job.
Yeah. It's not letterpress printed, but it's carefully designed by Jerry Kelly, an important designer in the U.S.
Yeah, it's quite apparent, and the illustrations are just beautiful, and also the printing is really quite beautiful. So
I think almost everyone who's seen the book has complimented its appearance.
Yeah, and if you're interested in history of printing at all, Oak Knoll is the place to go, aren't they? Because they not only publish books on printing, but they deal in other people's books, don't they? I mean, they're a bookstore, I think, as I remember.
Absolutely. So, yeah. They're located in Newcastle, Delaware. They have an amazing bookstore.
Yeah.
If you have any interest in books, it's totally worth a visit.
Yeah, yeah. Every librarian's shelf at home should be loaded up with Oak Knoll.
It's true.
Publications, yeah. So, I suppose, you know, a question I often ask people, do you have any projects on the stove at this point, future projects?
I absolutely do, and in fact the next stage is to extend this study into Europe.
Uh-huh.
You know, of course I was thinking of Europe as I was writing this book.
Well, you're a German scholar, right? So you might,
and
Germans must do Bibles, I mean, since Gutenberg.
They certainly do, and there are very close relations, especially in the early periods, between British printers and those on the continent.
Yeah.
I did feel for the purposes of this book that it was worth confining my study to the British Isles in North America, but I'm obviously aware that there's much to be said about this topic as it relates to Europe, and so I'm in the first stages of that study, and I hope to carry that forward and have that book out before too long.
Yeah, oh, great. So I don't know where you get the time between teaching, you know, running the library and also very serious research projects. But anyway, it's a great book and highly recommended. Anybody interested in the history of printing per se, and certainly in the history of the private presses, really should think about taking a look at it. I don't know if our bookstore carries it, but ask your library to get it. And it's wonderful for the illustrations. You wouldn't think necessarily type would be so beautiful, but it often is. And the illustrations, too. So many famous illustrators you have in here. And very colorful illustrations, a lot of them are. So I'd like to thank you, Ron, for visiting with us today in the Library Cafe to talk about your book, The Privately Printed Bible, Private and Fine Press Editions of Biblical Texts in the British Isles and North America by Oak Knoll Press.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Yeah, it's been great. We'll do this again.